didn't want to vote against certification. Some mistaken advice from a lawyer causes her to vote against her own certification. And if this happens this fall, and there are 10,000 jurisdictions like this, now we get into a much bigger problem. We're up against electoral college deadlines, congressional deadlines. And this is where, again, this large community of election administrators, moderate Republicans, and civil rights lawyers are very worried about what happens.
And Jim, of course, the biggest battleground state is that everyone is watching is Pennsylvania. Could you talk about the Supreme Court decision last Friday having to do with mail-in ballots there, and also what you're expecting, what you're looking for in this election now in terms of what happens at the county levels with vote counting and certification?
Right. Well, I'll say that the Supreme Court decision will affect ballots. It went against what Democrats would say the law was. So some ballots are not going to be able to be counted that Democrats say and that legally should be able to be counted. But separate from that, the certification issue is a big deal in Pennsylvania. In fact, in 2022, several counties in a standoff with the state would not certify for or wouldn't certify the total vote, because when a local jurisdiction has to certify, they have to certify every vote they get. Again, if they see problems, they mark it, leave it for the courts, prosecutors. So Pennsylvania is one of those states where we've seen a lot of issues around certification. And that everybody, now look, it's predictive. Today's election day, we'll see what happens. But Pennsylvania is one of the hot spots. And they missed their own state deadline in 2022 to get all their results in. It wasn't a presidential, the Electoral College wasn't involved, but they have missed a deadline because of some boards that were holding off on certification, at least the full certification. So all eyes are really on Pennsylvania as much as anywhere else, especially given the importance of the state.
And finally, as we end, Jim Rutenberg, if you can talk a little more about the Electoral Count Reform Act passed 2 years ago.
It's actually bringing that up. That is what gives election lawyers and administrators great heart. Congress passed a new law to make it harder to do something like January 6th. It set a new deadline for states to get their results in, the idea being that any kind of mucking around with certification will be fast-tracked by the courts. It raised the bar for people in Congress to object to results. So it tried to tighten things up. It clarified the vice president's role, even though really that didn't need clarifying. If listeners will remember, there was a pressure on Mike Pence to somehow reject these votes. It was not legally something he could do, but that's been clarified. The issue is the potential loophole. And again, this is a long shot, but it could be enough to inspire some people to try. There's a new hard deadline that I talked about. It's December 11 this year. And the law doesn't make it very clear that if a state is involved in some big certification fight or who knows what else and misses that deadline, it's not clear what happens. Now, the courts, people tell me, will sort that out. But if Congress is in full control of Republicans and Trump is lost, you could see that, and some people see that, as a pretext to say X state missed its deadline. We have to talk about the alleged fraud in that state, which is will be why it would have missed the deadline, as there will be allegations of fraud. And now do we get into a January 6th situation again?
Well, Jim Rutenberg, I want to thank you for being with us, writer at large for The New York Times and New York Times Magazine. We'll link to your recent articles, The Army of Election Officials Ready to Reject the Vote and Trump Preparing to Challenge the Results Puts His 2020 Playbook into Action, as well as your New York Times Magazine piece. Again, folks, tune in tonight on democracynow.org and to your radio and television station for our four-hour election special, War, Peace, and the Presidency, from 8 p.m. to midnight Eastern, also expanding tomorrow to 2 hours in the morning, 8 to 10 in the morning. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we look specifically more at Georgia, one of the seven key swing states that could decide the presidency. We're joined by Ari Berman, the voting rights correspondent for Mother Jones. He's the author of Minority Rule, the right-wing attack on the will of the people and the fight to resist it. His latest piece is headlined, How Election Deniers Took Over Georgia's Election System Ari, welcome back to Democracy Now! If you can take it from where Jim left off, and, you know, Georgia will be one of the first states where the voting booths close today, where we're going to know a lot. Talk about its significance and how it fits into your bigger look at what is happening in this country today.
Well, good morning, Amy. Good morning, Juan, and happy Election Day to you both. Georgia was really the epicenter of where the Trump campaign tried to overturn the 2020 election. He pressured the state's Republican Secretary of State. He pressured the state's Republican legislature. He pressured the state's Republican governor to overturn Biden's margin of victory. And when that failed, Trump and his allies really systematically tried to take over Georgia's election system. They took over county boards of election. We identified 21 election deniers sitting on county boards of elections. They took over this state election board, which issues rules and guidance to those county election boards. They have placed top officials, such as Lieutenant Governor in Georgia, who was a fake elector for Trump, in important statewide positions. So what the Trump movement has done is they've put all of these election deniers in positions of power in Georgia and other states, but we focus specifically on Georgia, so that they can spread disinformation, they can undermine trust in fair elections, and they ultimately can try to refuse to certify election results if Kamala Harris wins the state. And that is really what I'm concerned about here, is that this disinformation leads election officials not to certify fair election outcomes. And even if they do certify, this disinformation could lead to very scary outcomes, like potentially another January 6th.
And Ari, what's been the response of the courts in Georgia to these moves by the MAGA movement?
Well, the good news is that in Georgia, the courts blocked seven rules passed by Trump allies on the state election board that could have delayed the counting of votes and could have led officials not to certify election results. So the good news is the courts have stepped in Georgia, like they stepped in 2020, to ensure fair election outcomes. The worry here, though, is that election deniers are still in positions of power, Juan. So they could still spread disinformation. They could still undermine faith in fair elections. They could still refuse to certify election results in defiance of what the court has ruled. So I think what's shaping up after November 5th, if the election is close, is going to be a battle between the courts and a battle between rogue election officials that would like to defy the law. I believe that the rule of law will prevail here. I believe that the courts will ensure a fair election, but I also think election deniers can do a lot of damage because they're in greater positions of power than they were in 2020. On 2020, they were on the outside. They were banging on the doors trying to get in. Now they've gotten in those doors. They've gotten in those positions of power. They have election authority. And it's very dangerous to imagine what people who don't believe in free and fair elections can do when given the power to oversee those very elections.
But there's a big difference, Ari, isn't there? And that is, in 2020, Trump was in charge, right, of the federal government. Now he isn't, but you're talking about state election boards. So my question is, when you talk about a January 6th, you know, the insurrection in Washington, this image people have, over 100 police officers injured, a number died in that day and the days after. It's not exactly going to be in Washington, is it?
No, I think that's a really good point, Amy. The focus is going to be the state capitals now, because that's where Republicans have the most influence. They control all of state government in Georgia. So you're more likely to see an event at the Georgia state capitol than the U.S. capitol. But that said, there is a role that the federal government can play. And let me just outline one possible nightmare scenario, which is that local officials refuse to certify the election results in Georgia. That delays the counting of results. That means that Georgia misses its deadline to send its electoral votes to Congress. That could mean that no candidate has a majority in the Electoral College. If no candidate has a majority, that could mean that the election would be thrown to the GOP-controlled House, where a majority of state delegations, not a majority of the House, would select the next president. So you could see a situation where Trump loses the popular vote, does not win a majority of the Electoral College, but the election is still thrown to a Republican-controlled House who installs Trump as president nonetheless. That is a far-fetched scenario, but it is possible under the Constitution, and one of the things that I am concerned about as we're talking about this on Election Day.
And Ari, I wanted to ask you about another battleground state, Wisconsin. You wrote a piece for Mother Jones titled "The Democrats' Secret Weapon in Wisconsin." Can you talk about that?
Yes. So Wisconsin is a heavily gerrymandered state where Republicans have lopsided majorities in the state legislature. They have almost two-thirds supermajority in both chambers of the legislature, even though it's a 50-50 state. Those gerrymandered maps were struck down by the state Supreme Court last year, which means there are going to be competitive elections at the state legislative level in Wisconsin for the first time in nearly a decade and a half. And that's motivating a lot of people to vote in Wisconsin to try to flip that legislature blue instead of red. The conventional wisdom is that people vote for the top of the ticket and they forget about those down ballot races. And that's often true. But in Wisconsin, it could be the opposite. A lot of people are energized by what's happening at the bottom of the ticket. And one of the things I've been talking about more broadly is state legislatures are so critically important. They're the ones who pass laws on things like abortion, voting rights, gun control, so many other issues, and they don't get nearly as much attention as what happens at the top of the ticket. And these races are often decided by just a handful of votes. So I think not just in Wisconsin, but in other key swing states, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Arizona, there's critically important state legislative races that aren't getting nearly as much attention as the presidential race, but are going to go a long way towards shaping the direction of the country.
Ari, you also wrote a piece for Mother Jones headlined "Why Ballot Measures Are Democracy's Last Line of Defense." So, for example, you have actually 11 ballot measures in 10 states around abortion. Some people are talking about a scenario where this is the year of the women. Women do tend to vote more than men, and that across the political spectrum, even those who are concerned about abortion are deeply concerned. I mean, we saw it in the Des Moines Register poll that just came out. They just put into place a six-week abortion ban. You have women who are dying, who want to have children. Something happens with the pregnancy, and doctors are afraid to touch them, and they die. That this will drive women out in droves, especially around these ballot measures, where then, in their states, they will then vote for the top of the ticket. If you can talk about ballot measures.
The reason why I called ballot measures democracy's last line of defense is that direct democracy is really the only way in certain places to protect key rights from hyper-gerrymandered legislatures and right-wing courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court. So in many states, if you want to protect abortion rights, the only way to do so is through direct democracy, is through ballot initiatives. And that's why abortion rights initiatives are on the ballot in 10 states, including some really important swing states like Arizona. People are really motivated about this. Lots of states have passed six-week abortion bans that are incredibly unpopular with the public, including in places like Iowa. I think this is going to be a major sleeper issue in the election, the number of people that turn out for these ballot initiatives on issues like abortion. It's also broader than just abortion rights in terms of what's on the ballot. There are 150 ballot measures this cycle that voters are considering. There are things like banning partisan gerrymandering in Ohio. There are things like raising the minimum wage, protecting marriage equality. A lot of stuff is happening on the bottom of the ballot that isn't getting as much attention, but is critically important, and people are getting out. And I think what Democrats are trying to do is they're trying to link what's happening at the bottom of the ballot to the top and say that if you want to protect abortion rights in a place like Arizona, you also have to vote for candidates that are going to protect abortion rights like Kamala Harris compared to Donald Trump.
And Ari, I wanted to ask you about the issue of the Electoral College. You've been pretty vocal in your writings about the need to abolish it. Could you talk about why and what the prospects are for having actual elections that depend on the actual votes of all the people rather than on the Electoral College system?
So the Electoral College is undemocratic. It's antiquated and it's racist. It dates all the way back to slavery. It was put in to restrain democratic participation and to protect elite white power. And it creates a situation where you can lose the popular vote but win the Electoral College, where seven swing states representing 15% of the population decide the presidency to the detriment of 85% of Americans. It depresses voter turnout in states that aren't these prized swing states. So it depresses turnout in the 43 other states that aren't going to decide the presidency. And there is now a movement to abolish it called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. One way to do it is through a constitutional amendment. That's very hard. But through this National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, states that reach 270 electoral votes, they could then pledge to appoint the winner of their state to the winner of the popular vote nationwide. And right now, those states have 209 electoral votes. They're short of 270. But that's what happens. That's why what happens at the state legislative level is so important, because if Democrats can pick up places like Arizona, like Wisconsin, like Pennsylvania, they can then move to join this interstate compact to then abolish the Electoral College. So I think you're going to see renewed momentum to try to abolish the Electoral College if there is a popular vote Electoral College split this time, which there very well could be. But even if there isn't, I think we have to ask ourselves, why do we have this ticking time bomb every 4 years where someone could win the popular vote but lose the Electoral College? And why do we have a system that prioritizes a handful of swing states to the detriment of the rest of America?
Ari Berman, we want to thank you for being with us, voting rights correspondent for Mother Jones Magazine. We'll link to your pieces, how election deniers took over Georgia's election system, as well as the one on ballot measures. He is the author of Minority Rule, the right-wing attack on the will of the people and the fight to resist it. And Ari, we will see you tonight in our New York City studio as part of our four-hour election special from 8 p.m. to midnight Eastern time. We'll also be airing an expanded two-hour election show on Wednesday morning from 8 to 10 Eastern time. Next up, we look at a new Latino USA investigation into the misinformation web targeting Latinx voters in battleground states and beyond. Back in 20 seconds. Hooray for the riffraff. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We look now at how Spanish-language misinformation is targeting Latinx voters, a key demographic that could determine the outcome of this presidential election in key battleground states, including Nevada, Arizona, Pennsylvania, where both Kamala Harris and Donald Trump made dueling campaign stops on Monday. Trump's campaign continues to face widespread backlash over racist comments made by a far-right so-called comedian who described Puerto Rico as an island of garbage at Trump's Madison Square Garden rally. On Monday, Harris spent some of the last hours before Election Day in Allentown, Pennsylvania, a Latinx-majority city home to some 34,000 Puerto Ricans. Her visit came just days after Trump also spoke there. Pennsylvania has some 600,000 eligible Latinx voters, while one study found Arizona, another swing state, has 1.3 million registered Latinx voters, the fourth largest Latinx voter bloc in the nation. Latinx-led grassroots groups have largely backed Kamala Harris, are leading Get Out the Vote campaigns, while also fighting the spread of mis- and disinformation. Spanish-speaking communities have been bombarded by false claims, conspiracies, and fake news on social media platforms like TikTok, Facebook, and X, formerly Twitter, as well as WhatsApp channels. Voting rights groups also warn of the use of artificial intelligence, AI, to generate fake election content in Spanish. Well, Futuro Media and Latino USA looked into the misinformation web targeting Spanish speakers in the U.S., much of it propagated by conservative content creators living outside the U.S. This is a clip of host Maria Hinojosa talking to a man from Venezuela who goes by Juan Torres. He supposedly lives in Iceland and runs two YouTube channels.
So I asked him what he thinks about Trump being a convicted felon.
O sea, esos cargos que se le imputa a Donald Trump es mentira.
He says those charges, they're all lies. When I tell him that it's a fact that Donald Trump has been convicted of multiple felonies, Juan says it's all a witch hunt. Ultimately, Donald Trump was found guilty by a jury of his peers.
For more, joined by Maria Hinojosa, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, founder of Futuro Media, host of Latino USA, which has this new investigation podcast on the misinformation web. Maria, welcome back to Democracy Now! So lay out who Juan Torres is and also just your overall investigation.
Well, the investigation really, it ended up taking us, Amy and Juan, to where we didn't expect to be, right? Because both of the content creators, will be nice and call them content creators, live outside of the United States. They are not American citizens. They don't plan on being able to vote or move to this country anytime soon. And yet, John Acquaviva and Juan Torres, both Venezuelan, both under 30, both in Spanish, have YouTube channels, even though one is based in outside of London and the other one is based allegedly in Iceland. We did meet John Acquaviva in person in London, and so I'm pretty sure that he does live in that area. But basically, here's the thing, Amy. We understood that the Latino electorate was going to be central in terms of deciding this election today. And if you had intelligence, you were watching what was happening in terms of mis- and disinformation being flooded into Latino communities. What do I mean? So, yeah, 4 years ago, there were probably memes already about Kamala as a communist, dressed in a Mao Zedong outfit and at a so-called Communist Party office with a flag behind her. The Democrats and the party and the campaign did not really take it as seriously. So, therefore, the misinformation just spread, instead of being met with a wall of facts. And so that's why you have, you know, unexpectedly more Latinos and Latinas who are turning to Trump, because they have been fed two things. One, that Kamala is essentially a communist and a socialist. And two, that Donald Trump is an excellent businessman and is going to do amazing things for the U.S. economy.
And Maria, could you talk about the under the radar impact of a lot of this right wing Spanish language, especially social media usage throughout Latin America? That it, even some of the major social media companies are clearly not moderating their content at the same level in Spanish as they are in English.
Yeah. You basically on YouTube have about, I think it's about 28,000 moderators for, what, a billion views in a day, for example. It just doesn't match with what we're being faced with. The way I felt about it, Juan, and, you know, we're of a similar generation, right? So this is for those of us who have grown up during journalism on the front lines, you know, just like I was reporting from my precinct in Harlem, where I voted at 6 o'clock in the morning, that kind of frontline going to a community, meeting with people face to face. This kind of journalism is met with young men, a very bro-y culture, that yell at their screens, but in an attractive way, in a dramatic way. and basically repeat lies that they, one of them, John Juan Torres, says he's like, Twitter X is my only source. It's like, oh my God, that's scary. It feels completely out of control. It feels like the blob. That's the only image that I can say, right? This blob that is now, how do you put the genie back in the bottle? And again, the problem is for Latinos and Latinas, and for those of us who speak Spanish, there are less places to do the triple sourcing, triple fact checking that you learn in basic media literacy. And therefore, that's why the lies continue to get propagated.
I want to go to another clip from your Latino USA investigation, The Misinformation Web. This features one of the men you're talking about, John Acquaviva, a content creator who became more actively engaged in U.S. politics in the lead up to this election. You met him in London at a hotel. This is him.
10 minutes into our conversation, John, just like Juan Torres, tries to provoke a debate with me. So let me ask you, though, why would you put...
Because I like it. What's the problem? Obviously, you do produce your Against Drones, but that's just a different subject.
What did you say?
Obviously, you do see a problem with it, produce your Against Drones. Well, that's your opinion. I can have mine.
Wait a second. What are you talking about?
I've seen your opinions about gun control.
Opinions?
Yeah.
You'd have to specifically show me something that shows an opinion.
You've spoken endlessly about mass shootings.
Endlessly?
Yeah.
Okay.
I actually have some quotes. Do you want to read them?
No.
So that's John Acquaviva. But I found something really interesting in your podcast between John and Juan, and both being Venezuelan. You ask them why the U.S. election matters to you so much. And they're saying because it can ultimately affect the shaping of a new Venezuela.
Oh, yeah. And John Acquaviva wants to run for president of Venezuela. You know, of course, again, they both say that they are entirely focused on Venezuela, and yet they don't live there, and they're not these days talking about Venezuelan politics. They're obsessed with U.S. politics. But essentially, it would be the trickle down. If Trump wins, and both of them are Trump supporters, if Trump wins, that means that there is a possibility, of course, even of military intervention in Venezuela. I mean, we don't have that on in terms of a policy position, but of course, that could happen. My problem with where they stand on Venezuela is that they don't really go beyond the immediate of just let's get Trump elected, because of course I said, well, Trump is planning on having a mass deportation policy. That means tens of thousands of your fellow Venezuelans are going to be deported from the United States into Venezuela. How is that possibly going to benefit your country? They didn't have an answer for that. But the thing is that if Hugo Chavez had never existed, these two guys who are spreading mis and disinformation and lies would not exist. So there's a trickle of that leads to misinformation, sadly, right now.
And Maria, in one video, Torres claims that Kamala Harris supports Soviet-style policies, even though the Soviet Union no longer exists. This whole effort to paint Kamala Harris as a communist, how is that playing among Latin Americans here in the U.S.?
Well, you know, Juan, that for Cubans, right, the anti-communism, that piece of their history is very real, right? And there is a lot of trauma that we cannot diminish because they were, in essence, had to leave their country never to be able to go back. That is a lot of the South Florida political reality, right? Enter Venezuelans who are escaping from a horrible economy in Venezuela and, you know, a real tampering down of the democratic process in Venezuela over the past several years. So they come also with the trauma of, you know, of alleged communism, socialism. The problem for those of us who have a critical analysis, right, is that communism and socialism are very profound, deep concepts, and I don't believe that they have existed in either one of those places. But
there is... And, of course, they're the target of fierce U.S. sanctions to this day.
Fierce U.S. sanctions, but you know what? The point is that if you are getting Social Security in the United States today and you're benefiting from that, welcome to socialism in the United States of America. So people don't understand that, in fact, the policies that they critique are many of the ones that they're going to be benefiting from. But the point of the story is that there's a vacuum of people who hear communist, socialist, scary. It's going to change the United States. It's going to become like Cuba. It's going to become like Venezuela.
3 seconds.
And they're going to vote for Donald Trump. That's what we've seen.
Maria Hinojosa, we thank you so much for being with us. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
CJSF is 90.1 FM, broadcasting from the heights of Burnaby Mountain.
Thank you.